This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July the 5th, 2016. Current federal tax developments, as always, is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be bringing you a few issues this week that we'll look at here on federal taxes. We're going to look at a few things. This week, we take a look at the Security Summit, I'll pronounce that right, report for 2016 was issued. And preparer security is going to be a major issue in the coming year we need to be aware of. We'll talk about an IRS letter that deals with the interaction between crowdsourcing and taxes that the IRS discussed. We'll talk about the fact that we had a case this week where a taxpayer's testimony proved to be the key thing that the tax court relied upon in showing the taxpayer was insolvent in a cancellation of debt issue. We'll talk about a problem the taxpayer had trying to get the IRS to believe that a medical condition was really the reason why she was unable to complete an IRA rollover. The Ninth Circuit tells us that Congress didn't just intend for the tax court to consider the issue of whether a taxpayer, a partner in this case, had their statute of limitations open or not, but rather expected them to rule on that issue and actually allowed them to rule either way. And the Federal Circuit took a look at what's going to count for interest netting purposes when we have a change in members of a consolidated group of corporations, something that happens quite often when we talk about large corporate entities and public companies. Well, this is the time of year we have a few things happening, and we've got a few courses coming up I want to highlight for you, the various state societies. Butch Rogers has a pair of courses coming up later in July at Mahoney State Park in Nebraska. That includes on July 21st, oil and gas taxation, landowners and investors, and church and minister taxation on July the 22nd. Later on in the month of August, I'll be going on, went a little too far there, to Columbus, where I'll be putting on a pair of courses on August 18th on fringe benefits and August 19th on identity theft and tax practice. The latter obviously being a significant issue that came up in, now we're ready to move forward to our developments for this week, the Security Summit of the IRS. This came out in IRS news release, IR 2016-94 and fact sheet 2016-21 that was issued at the end of June. The Security Summit is a conference, a group that the IRS sponsors that has members from various organizations that are concerned with identity theft and the security of taxpayer data. That includes the various state departments of revenue. That includes the tax preparation industry, including the consumer one and for the ones dealing with preparers and tax preparers. And what they're doing is getting together to try to get control over the fact of refund fraud and identity theft that results from tax issues. And it outlined the highlights of the 2016 conference and the issues that we have gone to apply higher standards. And they told us some of the big things they've accomplished this year, including requiring people to have more secure passwords on consumer tax preparation sites. That's one of the big problems that we had a year before, where it turns out with password leaks, and yes, by the way, if you hadn't been aware of that, password leaks have now come out and bit a few major basically tech industry leaders where their passwords had been reused on sites and they had kind of forgotten. And ended up being able to be taking over other accounts of theirs, which they also weren't paying much attention to. But the reuse of passwords becomes much more serious when we talk about things like tax return preparation, because there, if somebody used the same password on LinkedIn a number of years ago, which, by the way, had one of the major password breaches, and the full database apparently now has been released from a few years ago, if somebody had not changed their password on their tax site from what they put on LinkedIn, well, then it's pretty easy to get in. So we started requiring more secure passwords. Bad news is we still can't really make sure you're not using the same password on every site, which is going to continue to be a problem. But they talked about those developments this year and some other developments that they had coming out of the summit. We basically have a whole bunch of new data points they're looking at to try to pick up where they have fraudulent returns. And the IRS noted that they had a much lower number, finally, of actual identity theft situations they claimed that went forward this year with bad refunds. Now, one of the key things for those of us here is they've announced they will be reaching out to preparers to improve their security. This is significant. We already had, as we discussed earlier, we've had the IRS release information on preparer security and what's expected. We're going to see that expanded now with additional rules being involved. Some people may have noticed this week the newest update to QuickBooks is requiring more secure passwords if there are personally identifiable information in a database. If you have a QuickBooks database that has like EIN numbers in it, we're going to probably see that expand out to a whole bunch of other programs. Don't be surprised if your tax software also starts requiring you to have a more secure, complex password. The idea being if somebody breaks in your network, they can't just go directly and log in the tax program. They've got to be able to give a more secure password to get that done. We're going to see reach out to the preparer community by the IRS looking to try to get preparers to be involved in this. We've already seen attacks on preparers where people are trying to take over tax preparer systems, infiltrate them, maybe quietly, in order to both get the data that's there and to use them to file fraudulent returns, because those returns will look like they're coming from a good site. Finally, the program and the news release in the fact sheet talks about some of the 2017 programs that we'll be seeing. We're going to see an expansion of the W-2 verification code that ran as a test this past year, asking for putting verification codes on W-2s that will allow them to do some checking before the actual number, before the actual W-2s are sent in to the IRS. So you'll probably see the payroll services start expand that. And I would expect eventually all payroll service W-2s will have that on it. We'll see more data elements are going to be checking to try to spot returns that are fraudulent. There'll be a new ID theft center they'll be establishing for the IRS to do this. And as already mentioned, there'll be an awareness campaign for preparers. Be sure to look for all of this coming up here. We're going to see a lot more developments, and this is something that's simply not going to go away. Expect a lot more to come out this year and expect it to require you to make some changes in your practice. That simply is how it's going to go. Well, another issue that we've seen in tech, which is a problem we've run into, is tech has been known to change how we do business. One of the ways that we've seen a change recently has been the growth of crowdfunding. People may be aware of sites like Kickstarter, and that's just the largest. There are a whole bunch of sites that do this, where a group of people pledge money, put up money in exchange to get some project going. It's a growing method of funding for startups. In fact, Forbes had an article on their website that noted that this year, we're going to expect for this to actually grow to, look at my notes, $34 billion of crowdfunding money this year, which will exceed what's expected to be invested by the venture capital industry this year in projects. So it's a significant area. The problem we've got into is, what's the tax status of these? Now, these projects, people put money up, they put money in, the project gets running. In some cases, if the project doesn't meet its goal for funding, the money's refunded. In other cases, these people may, you know, they put their money in, they might get some sort of special, let's say when the product finally ships, they'll get a special engraved version or some different version that indicates they were there to start the project. Well, the question becomes, what's the tax nature of this? And we had an IRS information letter issued in response to a question about how in the world should this thing be taxed? And the IRS look at gives a discussion some of the general topics. First, they looked at the Section 61 issues. That is this gross income money that comes in? And basically, as the IRS points out, Section 61 is very broad on what's income. And they note that effectively, you're only going to be able to exclude it under very limited circumstances. First, did you purchase an equity interest? In most cases, that will not be true. These people are not buying an equity interest in the enterprise. We also take a look at some of the other issues. Could it be a loan? Well, you might think, well, it has to be repaid. Maybe it's a loan. Not really. The intention of the parties is going to be to not have this money be repaid. Therefore, it looks, at least to this observer, to be a lot more like a claim of right problem. And then the third question is, well, if it's not either one of those, is it a gift? And even in a case where you don't get anything directly, it still seems unlikely this is the same thing as a gratuitous transfer. So in all likelihood, it appears this money is income. The next question, though, becomes, was it received or constructively received, or when would it be? And for that, the IRS notes, you have to look at the rules that are involved and the limitations on the income, and you don't include self-imposed limitations. Some people are attempting to crowdsource on their own, come to my website, give me money, and then I'll do this project if we get enough. As the IRS notes, you know, self-imposed restrictions aren't really going to count in this case. But in other cases, you may have ones where the site, let's say somebody like Kickstarter, really doesn't release the funds. Now we get into a different question. And as the IRS notes, this is heavily a facts and circumstances situation. So in reality, what the service ends up telling us here is that crowdfunding is one of these things where the specific facts of your situation are going to matter. And so our question is going to be, you know, what are those facts? That means you've got to take a look at how things work. It also means, as the service notes, if this is large and seriously important to you, you probably need to be looking to get a private letter ruling, because that's the only way to get something where we look at the specific facts of your case and then take a look at what the law would be in that situation. Next up, we have the case of Newman versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-125, issued on June the 28th. Now, this is an interesting case because previously we've had cases, and we've looked at some of these here, like the McAllister case, where the tax court was very, very skeptical of a taxpayer who claimed to be insolvent and, in fact, appeared to impose a very high standard on the taxpayer in order to prove insolvency in court. That led a lot of us to be concerned with, you know, because we had a lot of people at cancellation of debt last in, you know, basically the early part of this decade after the real estate, you know, especially the home fiasco that came apart and people get out of those mortgages, or they came up for it to be redone. The balloon came due and there was no way to refinance. So there was large COD. Now, in some cases, those were not first residences, so they didn't qualify as primary. So we have problems with cancellation. In this case, what we have is, this is a little different. The taxpayer opened a brand new bank account and deposited a check there from another bank and took out $8,000. Now, I'm a little interested in how the guy got the money out of the new bank to begin with, because it always seems like anytime I've ever tried to establish a bank even for a small amount, there are huge restrictions right at the beginning. But it appears this guy got the money out the door. Now, when the bank he deposited the check in went to the other bank, well, they refused payment. So basically, now we got a bad check. This guy never made the balance good. What happened was, 3 years later, the bank, in this case, issued him a 1099-C. The tax court in this case did go back to its all-time favorite, the 36-month rule, to look at when a cancellation event took place. If you're not aware of the 36-month rule, that's technically under the rules for filing a 1099-C when one should be filed. And the law generally says if there's been no collection activity and no payments for 36 months, and there's no payments through the end of the year where the 36-month period ends, that if there has not already been an event that would trigger cancellation of debt recognition, that the lender should issue the 1099-C there. While it's an information reporting segment, the tax court has used it regularly for the purposes of determining whether there was cancellation, when it was. So the tax court said, you know, okay, it was canceled in that year. That's the correct year. But then it actually, in this case, a little differently than we saw in earlier cases, it accepted the taxpayer's own testimony as believable that the taxpayer was insolvent. Probably took a look at the general information the taxpayer had, did not require, apparently in this case, specific valuations, simply determined that the taxpayer was insolvent and, in this case, was insolvent to at least the amount of the $8,000 that was the cancellation of debt in this situation. So the good news is it appears that we don't have things quite as dire and quite the problem that we seem to have for some of the earlier cases, where taxpayers who have cancellation of debt and have an insolvency defense ended up with a ridiculous problem of having to pay huge amounts of money to value everything, which they didn't have, or face tax. It appears that if your taxpayer is believable and it's obvious on its face that the taxpayer is insolvent, that the tax court will consider that. In essence, like quite often when we have cases like this, there are unfortunately facts we just don't know about in detail, but believability of the taxpayer was key in this case. In the case of Newman, the believability of the taxpayer is what allowed the taxpayer to go ahead and get the cancellation of debt income not taxable to himself. Useful in that case. Next up, we're going to take a look at it in this case, private letter ruling 2016-25022, a taxpayer's failed attempt to get the IRS to give them a late rollover of an IRA. In this case, the taxpayer withdrew funds from an IRA to prevent her daughter from losing her home. She thought that they were going to close on the sale of a house that they had before the 60 days were up. So she took the money, because they didn't have the sales money yet, took the money from the bank, from the IRA, gave it to her daughter. Her daughter didn't lose her home, apparently. And then her idea was, well, we're going to close this sale within the 60 days. As often happens, if you don't have a real estate sale closed on the first day, I don't care how much you're sure it's going to close within 60 days, things always seem to go wrong. Anybody who's been through a real estate transaction knows how things go wrong. In this case, it did. At the date, therefore, when the 60th day came by, the sale had not closed, and there were no funds available to complete the rollover. So this is a problem. The account, the money was not paid back in. Generally, that would seem to be a problem, because the IRS does not grant late rollover relief because you borrowed from it. That's one of the things the IRS says, while that's okay, you know, the law allows you to do it, that Congress's intent was to do this simply to move funds from one account to another, not to give you a chance to borrow from your IRA. So yeah, if you stay within the 60 days, no problem. But if you get outside of it, we're not going to bless you for that. Well, in this case, though, the taxpayer said, okay, I understand that, but here's my catch. I had medical issues, and had I not had those issues, my husband would have gone out, withdrawn from his IRA, and then that would have allowed us to make that payment. His IRA had sufficient funds, and he could have taken from that. Then we'd have 60 more days, and my medical conditions are what prevented me from being able to do that. So the question becomes, well, you know, does that make sense? And the IRS said, well, you know, we have a little problem with your statement here. First, of course, the funds weren't really available. Secondly, this didn't happen. More to the point, which was kind of interesting, was the IRS noted that this taxpayer continued to work and travel, and that she continued to do all this stuff. They didn't really accept her reasoning that medical was the reason why she didn't complete the rollover. They said, no, in fact, you know, you traveled, you continued to work. You could have easily, you know, you're telling me you traveled, you continued to work, but you couldn't talk to your husband, who had to be the one to go take the money out anyway to get your IRA rollover done. Doesn't make sense. So because of that, the IRS disallowed the taxpayer's attempt to get, or disallowed permission for the taxpayer to make a late rollover. Again, you've got to be plausible in your reasons. Next up, let's take a look at the issue of, in this case, a TEFRA partnership case, MK Hillside Partners et al. Versus Commissioner. This is case number 1471504 from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, 2016, tax notes today, 122-8, issued on June the 27th. Now, this was a problem because we have a partnership that was a tax shelter. But the IRS, as quite often, one of our problems here was the IRS had the shelter, not our problem, IRS's problem. They didn't actually get around to going after the shelter till more than 3 years had closed. So the statute, the normal statute, was closed. However, the IRS case was going to be against the partner, that there was a substantial omission of income, therefore the six-year statute would run. Now the taxpayer, remember, this is a TEFRA partnership. In a TEFRA partnership engagement, TEFRA partnership exam, the first exam takes place at the partnership level. Now, under the code, one of the things you can do, and one of the provisions allowed here under Section 6226, which governs partnership exams under TEFRA rules, allows a partner to step in and protest and raise to the tax court, saying that, you know, wait, the statute is closed on me, so this is irrelevant. In fact, what the code section says, which is Section 6226F, says any person that is a partner under this, you know, party to an action, is permitted to participate in the transaction, essentially, and the tax court basically shall be able to consider the question of whether the statute is open or not for that person. Now, in this case, the taxpayer said, hey, wait, you know, I don't think the six-year statute doesn't apply. The tax court, therefore, they moved for the tax court to dismiss the TEFRA case, because if that didn't apply, it was an irrelevant case. The tax court didn't buy the taxpayer's argument, but more to the point, ruled specifically the statute was open. Now the taxpayer is upset because that ruling would essentially prevent them, when the IRS goes to assess tax against them, from being able to raise this defense at their level, because that would be relitigating something it already litigated. So they argue that, no, that wasn't allowed. The appellate panel said, thanks, guys, but no thanks. We're not buying your story. They said, look, if you read this section the way you want us to read it, you're telling us that the tax court couldn't rule on this case. They can only think about it. They said, well, that seems absurd. But actually, you didn't even say that. You said they could think about it. They could dismiss it if they believe the statute was closed, but they had to keep their mouth shut if the statute's still open. Court said that also didn't make sense. Sorry. The tax court in this proceeding could rule, if you bring this up, they can rule on the 6-year statute. And when they do so, that's going to be binding. Okay. Next up in our case, in our final case for the week, we're going to take a look at Wells Fargo & Company versus United States. This is a Federal Circuit case, number 2015-5059, 2016 tax note today, 126-15, issued on the 29th of June. Now, this is a case that had been in the Court of Claims a couple of years ago. Under the tax law, under the rules that we have here, which actually is important if you're a large corporation because there's a significant difference between the rate of interest you pay on overpayments and the rate of interest you pay on underpayments. The code allows specifically for you to basically net periods of overpayments and underpayments. The same corporation can net those payments. So if I'm overpaid in 2012, but I'm underpaid in 2013, I can take that overpayment and net it against the underpayment in 2013 if they're both outstanding. The question, though, becomes, what does it mean by the same corporation when we have corporations where there's continuous changes? In this case, as you can see from the plaintiff is Wells Fargo. And during the time period in questions, there were a ton of mergers and different entities that by the time we got to the IRS assessments at question here, had previously been separate banks and now operated as one bank. So the question became, how do we do this? Well, the Court of Claims had ruled that once there's a merger, all those predecessor corporations were considered the same corporation. Therefore, any assessments against any of them, any overpayments by any of them in any year could be offset. Now, the IRS said, the IRS disagreed with that position. The IRS position was very simply that we should have what's called the same TIN rule. Only if the same ID number existed on the return that was filed, on the two returns for the years involved, could you net the interest. The Federal Circuit took a look at this and said, well, we don't think either the Court of Claims or the IRS is correct. The Court of Claims had agreed with Wells Fargo. Rather, they took a look at a different set of situations. What they had in this case was a situation that dealt with. So their first situation they dealt with was, let's say, a case where we have in year one, we have an acquired corporation that has an overpayment of taxes. In year two, the survivor had an underpayment of taxes, and in year three, the two corporations are merged. Effectively, the Federal Circuit said in that case, because the survivor and the predecessor were the same corporation, that effectively, and we have this, they may be the same corporation, but at the time in which the overpayment arose and the time at which the underpayment arose, they were not part of the same group. They were separate. As such, since they were never combined for either one of those, we can't offset the two. Okay? They said that's very simple. In situation two, we have the survivor has an overpayment in year one and an underpayment in year two, but they merge with another corporation in the interim. The court held, well, in that case, there, the overpayment and underpayment arose from the same corporation. So because of that, they're saying that's also clearly no problem. The mere fact that we have new parties now that are merged into what had been a corporation for years ago is no problem. And the IRS agrees with that because that's the same TIN rule, because it would have used the same taxpayer ID number. But now let's take a look at case three. Case three is the third case in this issue. In this case, we have an overpayment, acquired as an overpayment in year one, and in year two, survivor and acquired merge. And in year three, we now discover there's an underpayment for survivor post-merger. Now, the IRS says, well, you know, because of the same TIN rule, you can't net those two. The Federal Circuit said, sorry, we don't buy this. We're looking to see if they're the same corporation. Because acquired was merged into survivor. And then afterward, we have an assessment of tax against survivor, which now really is a combination of those two corporations. The same corporation rule will still apply. So for that reason, we can continue to treat that as the same corporation, and we can net the taxes in that case. So in that case, they said, we're going to allow you to treat that as netting. We're going to look at when the membership of the group, when the specific items arose, and look at it under the three cases. So it was a partial reversal of the Federal Circuit, or I should say the Court of Claims, and a partial sustaining, but the logic was different than had been used by the Court of Claims. Well, you know, it's this time of year now. We're getting in. We're taking a look at all the neat things you get to do. Please remember to consider signing up for State Society summer courses that Working With, because, again, that's what brings you this weekly podcast, is our ability to work with the State Societies. And there's been a lot of things happening. You know, we have all of those fun issues. You've already now done your 8971s, hopefully, for those groups that got it delayed. But we still have all the neat stuff coming up with the partnership tax changes. We have all the other stuff that may be coming up with IRS developments going forward. All of these things getting ready for the upcoming tax season, you should be sure. Check your State Society's websites. There are tons of very useful and very important courses that will be available to you from all kinds of providers. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of July the 5th, 2016. Be sure to check our website for daily updates at currentfederaldevelopments.com, or at least if not daily, very, very regular updates, shall we say. You can also download a PDF of the articles with all of today's topics on that webpage, on our weekly update page. And be sure to check your State Society of CPAs websites, as I mentioned, for all the full-day courses. If you have any questions or comments, send them to edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at edzollers, will be my link there. And we look forward to seeing you next week as we talk about new developments coming up here in the area of federal.